From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air Weekend.
A tempestuous younger male with an aggressive streak.
Today, the social lives of chimpanzees, tigers, lions, penguins, and wolves. We hear from Michael Gunton, executive producer of the BBC series Dynasties, that follows groups of these animals over the course of years. Also, we talk about how the brain responds to addictive drugs and alcohol with neuroscientist Judith Grizzell. She's a recovering addict and initially wanted to become a neuroscientist after realizing that addiction was a disease and therefore maybe had a cure.
I think I wanted to study addiction so I could use better.
Seriously?
Yeah. I think it was a little unconscious, but I figured if it's a disease and diseases can be cured and I can cure it, then maybe I can still use.
And Ken Tucker reviews new albums by two guitarists, Steve Gunn and Michael Chapman. First News. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. There's a lot of great dramatic television these days, and our subject today is a series where none of the stars are professional actors. In fact, none of them are human. Dynasties is a new five-part BBC series focusing on groups of animals from five different species, each with rich and complex social lives. There's an hour each on lions, chimpanzees, tigers, painted wolves, and emperor penguins. Naturalists and camera crews followed each group for up to 2 years, long enough so that the episodes reveal the social relationships among the animals, their kinship and affection, as well as their rivalries and power struggles. Real plot lines develop and drama unfolds. The series is narrated by David Attenborough. Our guest is the executive producer, Michael Gunton. He has advanced degrees in zoology and animal biology and is creative director of the Factual and Natural History Unit of the BBC, where he spent most of his career. Dynasties premiered January 19th. It's airing on BBC America, AMC, IFC, and Sundance TV, and will soon be available on demand. Gunton spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies.
Well, Michael Gunton, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, there have been lots of terrific TV films and series about animals over the years. Many you've participated in with David Attenborough, but this one was different. You're putting a ton of cameras and equipment and personnel, committing them to a family for 2 years, and it is remarkable. You had to pick the right families, in effect, cast the series for them.
Yeah, I've used that expression, and it does sound strange in the terms of documentary, but actually that is exactly what we had to do, because the only way I felt this would work is if you could be sure, or as sure as you possibly can be, you can never be sure in nature, that one, the animals were box office animals, that they had real charisma and people would want to watch them. Two, that we could get access to them and that they had scientific backing, that there were scientists studying them so that we knew the stories we were telling were true. But most importantly, that we needed to be pretty sure that something tumultuous was going to happen in their lives. It was going to be a real change because, you know, we called this series Dynasties, or Dynasties, as you said, because it is about power struggles within families and about animals trying to either hold on to their rulership or take over. So we wanted to make sure that there was going to be real dramatic action.
So these are really involves plot lines, in effect, among individuals. I guess the penguins is a little different, but
yeah.
Among four of the five, you have these real struggles that develop among individuals in the species. And I thought we'd listen to one clip. This is from the episode called Chimpanzee, where you follow a group of chimpanzees, and there's an alpha male named David. He's been named by the scientists who've been studying them. He's had that role for 3 years, which is around the time these things typically change. He's kind of a very mature alpha male. And in this little section, we're going to hear David Attenborough narrates as the chimps are eating termites from a big mound. Let's listen.
These chimps have learnt to use grass stems as tools to fish out the insects. As leader, David gets his pick of the feeding spots. But he is wary, as he must feed alongside old enemies. He has two particularly ambitious rivals. David's toes begin to twitch, a nervous tic he can't conceal. This is Jumpkin, who has long sought the top spot. And this, Luther. A tempestuous younger male with an aggressive streak. The troop is together for the first time in months, and jostling for good feeding spots can easily lead to clashes. It's vital that David keeps order and defuses the situation. All eyes are on him. His display shows he is in control.
Oh, that's a rumble. That is David Attenborough in the series Dynasty. Our guest is the executive producer, Michael Gutton. This is a fascinating story. And when you invested in following these groups, did the crews know what the plot lines of the story would be?
Well, that's the key thing. When I was thinking about how this might work and sort of selling the idea to my bosses who are actually going to have to pay for it, you know, one of the things I was saying to them is that these will end up feeling quite like drama, but they cannot be plotted because these are true observational documentaries. We have the confidence is that if we know enough about these animals and enough about their situation, that we're pretty certain something is dramatic is going to happen, and we will just follow that action as it happens. There are certainly times when things weren't happening, or things were happening we weren't predicting, and we weren't being able to kind of work out what was going to happen. But I think that's what has made them so exciting to watch as viewers, because they feel they are witnessing something that they really do not know what's going to happen, in the same way that we didn't. So for the crews, it's kind of keeping your wits about you all the time about where's this heading? Who's, is that animal going to make its move now to challenge, or is something else going to happen here? So in shooting it, it's quite an unusual situation because you're kind of having to cover almost everything, but also you have to really concentrate on the detail, because sometimes the clue and the thing that the audience want to see may be quite a subtle movement, like a little look or a little baring of its teeth. So these were 2 years, sometimes longer, filming these creatures, and to keep that kind of concentration and that intensity of following them and trying to film them was a unique thing we've not done before.
And some of these animals really range over large areas. How did you keep track of that?
Well, every one of these films had its own logistical challenge in that sense, because with chimpanzees, they don't move very far, but when they do move, they go. And this is a really tough habitat. That forest is 40 degrees centigrade. That's 40 degrees centigrade. I don't know what that is in Fahrenheit, but it's very hot and humid and ghastly. And then when we were filming the painted wolves, they range over enormous areas. So you're in vehicles, you're using drones to follow them. At one point, we had about five different crews following those two packs. With the emperor penguins, that's not a case of they don't move anywhere, but you have to be out there in minus 40 degrees centigrade, which I think is actually the same as minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit, and even colder with wind chill. And that's the most brutal place on planet Earth. So every single one of these things has a particular kind of logistical challenge that you have to adapt your crews and your filmmaking approach, in fact, to accommodate.
It was fascinating. At the end of each of the episodes is a few minutes in which we meet the crew and they talk about what they do. And in the one on painted wolves, these wild dogs that work in, there are two packs that you follow. Mm-hmm. One of the trackers said he could distinguish them by smell.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. In fact, there is a situation where the vehicle drives over a dropping. One of the painted wolves had a poo there, and they drove over it. And as they drove over it, it squished it, so it released some smell. And he said, "Stop, we're following a different pack here. That's the other pack." And they had some radio tracking devices, and they flipped, because they couldn't find the wolves. They flipped the frequency on the radio tracking, and then it went bing, 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 and it was the other pack. And he could tell, because the diet of that particular pack, they had switched to hunting baboons, and the smell of baboon remains in the dog's feces, he could smell. It is kind of weirdly uncanny what they can do, actually. It sort of feels kind of magical.
Yeah. What dangers did the crew face?
We get asked this a lot about the dangers from, and people I assume they mean from the animals. And to be honest, there's almost no danger from the animals, because if there was, we wouldn't be doing our job right. Because I think if the animals are aware of you, or if you're in a situation where you might be attacked or might put yourself in danger, you have stepped too close, or you have done something that is disturbing the natural course of events. So really, the dangers we face are really driving around, flying around, going in boats, or occasionally bumping into people with guns.
Oh, really? People with guns?
Well, okay. On this series, that didn't really happen, but that, you know, in my career, the most scared I've ever been is bumping into roadblocks in some of the more hostile parts of the world, and with seeing people who were scared and weren't quite sure what to do, and maybe we didn't have much in common in language, and yeah, that's scary.
Right.
Well, I've never been scared by, well, actually that's not true. I have been scared by a rhino once, but pretty much in 35 years, I've never really been scared by an animal.
We're listening to the interview Fresh Air's Dave Davies recorded with Michael Gunton, executive producer of the BBC series Dynasties. We'll talk more after a break, and rock critic Ken Tucker will review new albums by guitarists Steve Gunn and Michael Chapman. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air Weekend.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Rhodes Scholar, a nonprofit organization offering educational learning adventures for families, grandparents, and grandchildren. A catalog is available at roadscholar.org. And from Progressive Insurance, committed to protecting cars and drivers, whether on the open road or having a driveway moment while listening to NPR. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to the interview Fresh Air's Dave Davies recorded with Michael Gunton, the executive producer of the BBC series Dynasties. The series provides a close look at five species of animals: lions, chimpanzees, tigers, painted wolves, and emperor penguins. The episodes reveal the complex social relationships of these animals, showing kinship and affection, and sometimes deadly power struggles. Each group of animals was followed for years by camera crews and naturalists.
They must get attached to the animals they follow. I mean, they, you know, in some cases follow these individuals for 2 years. And there are cases, I mean, where the team could choose to intervene. There was one amazing scene where in the lion episode where it's a young male lion named Red, I think, wanders into a bunch of hyenas.
Yeah.
You know, describe what happens there?
Young males in virtually all animals, ourselves included, often think they're a bit tougher and a bit braver and a bit cleverer than they really are. And one of the young males in this, in Charm's Pride, as they do at this stage, just before they're beginning to actually probably leave and go off and live their own lives, he was wandering around thinking he was a bit of a, you know, a bit invincible, and ended up caught in a kind of a corral of hyenas, and very quickly discovered that he was completely outnumbered, and the hyenas decided that they were going to take him out, and they just would not leave him. And they, what, of course, if he got one of them in his jaws, you could kill them instantly, but they were very clever. They'd run in, some of them would run in and he'd snap at them, and the others would then run in and bite him on his rear, and they were basically trying to wound him and weaken him so that they could eventually, well, we don't know if they would have killed him, but it looked like that was what they were trying to do. And this was going on and on and on, and he was trying to fight them off, and then they would fight, and you could see he was getting weaker, tired, and it didn't look like it was going to end happily. There was a lot of a huge cacophony of sound, you know, rumpus of all this going, the howling of the hyenas, him roaring, all the rest of it. His half-brother was also out and about and heard this in the distance and looked over and came running over. And when he saw it, he ran in. And as soon as the hyenas saw there was another male lion, they scarpered, because suddenly there were two jaws to bite rather than just one. And that the odds were then completely against them. And so that his half-brother basically saved his life.
Right. But I think we as the audience, and I'm sure the crew that was filming it, were thinking, oh, my God, we're going to see this. Yeah. Animal that we've developed this affection for ripped to pieces. Wow.
But the thing about that, you know, if you, people say, you know, talking about intervention, what would you do? I mean, as an observer of a camera crew, if you walked in there, you'd probably end up being eaten by one or other of them.
Drive a vehicle towards them? No.
Yeah, but then what would they then? Would the lion turn on you? Would the hyenas turn on you? Also, you have to take a kind of a judgment call that you're interfering with what is, you know, the rhythms of life, if you like. He had made a mistake, and that was what was going to happen. And I think if you'd intervened in that way, I think it would be a very difficult thing to justify. It's heartbreaking, but I think you take a view. There's not a rule, but you judge every situation on its own merits. And there was another situation in the series when there was a difference, where we took a different view. But in that particular case, I think you just observe what you're seeing and let nature take its course.
You know, there are some cases where animals, I think in the lion episode, where one of the young ones is ill and can't travel, and at some point, I mean, the pride will come back to check, but in the end, they can't do much, and the animal is left. And it's interesting that the painted wolves, who travel in packs, seemed just fiercely committed to taking care of each other, even like when one of them was had a lame leg, they just wouldn't let go.
Absolutely. I mean, I suppose one of our hopes was that when you make a film about an animal like a painted wolf, everybody knows and admires lions, but an animal like a painted wolf is a kind of a bit of a misunderstood, a bit of a, you know, in some people's eyes, a bit of a villain in nature films. And it's wrong to kind of, I think, to paint animals as good or bad. You know, they're all trying to make their living. They're all trying to do the best they can. And the truth of it is actually that painted wolves are extraordinary animals. And actually, it's often lions are the baddies, and if there was one in those situations. And, you know, that story about the way they look after their pack, their co-pack members, is remarkable. They're one of the few animals that will have this kind of social care, if you like, for their fellows. But, and part of that, I'm sure, is because the pack is more efficient and more effective when numbers are high. They're much better at hunting. So, it, in biological or evolutionary terms, it's good to keep your numbers up. But nevertheless, they do have this, you know, uncanny ability to tend to the old and the weak and the sick and the injured. And I think for that, they should be, you know, we should be admiring them.
Right. And there was also one amazing sequence, which we see one of them eaten by a crocodile. Mm. Pack takes it hard.
You know, if you talk to the director, Nick, who spent so much time with those animals, he felt that there were things that were going on in those animals' minds that you absolutely could connect with as a human being in a way that people would describe as being anthropomorphic, and he would absolutely deny it to the bitter end. He said the complexity and the nuance and the emotion that those animals show was, you know, and we did our best to show as much of that as we can in the film, but it's, you never can, perhaps you can never completely reflect the realities of that. And that's one of the things I think that the series is trying to do, is that these are individual animals and they think and they plan and they have complex lives, and they need to be respected and kind of considered in that way, because that's probably a good way of making sure that we perhaps look after them, and you start to see them as individuals who are struggling in the same way that we struggle. That gives an empathy with them that may be a powerful way of helping us care about them, because if you care about them, you want to look after them, protect them.
You know, the crew spent like 2 years with a lot of these animals and really got to know them. There must have been a terrible separation to leave. I mean, missing your kids.
Absolutely. And each of the directors is absolutely adamant that their animal is the best. They don't quite get to fisticuffs, but, you know, there is this kind of pride. But you're right. And I think it was tough for them to be dispassionate when they saw these things, particularly as the films got later and later, you know, further and further through the production, which is why I think when they do end with a triumph of some description at the end, I think it's particularly poignant and particularly rewarding for them. You know, in the Emperor Penguin film, Lindsay, who is the cameraman, he says, right, it's the very last thing he says, is that, you know, I've been here a year. I'm desperate to get home. I should say that while he was there, his wife had given birth to their first child, and he hadn't seen his child. The child was 4 months old when he got home. So he was absolutely desperate to get home and see his family and his new baby. But he said, but a part of me doesn't want to go, because the place and the animals and the story and that world just gets to you in a way that is almost inescapable. Well, so it does absolutely, you know, be experiencing this kind of thing does never leave you.
And that's from a guy living in Antarctica.
Well, yeah, I mean, the story there is great, because, you know, when we decided to do that film, you have to find a crew who are prepared to leave their home and live in Antarctica for nearly a year. And for about 8 months of that, they are on their own with seven other scientists. That basically, there's a station there, an overwintering station, which has some scientists and some people monitoring weather and some geophysics and stuff. That's it. Those are the only people there. And for two or three months of that time, it's completely pitch black. There's no sun. Your only light is from the moon, and it's brutally cold. And you had to find someone to do that. And amazingly, this young guy, Lindsay, said, I've always wanted to go and film Emperor Penguins. I'd love to do it. And so he said he signed up to say, I'll do it. And then he got married, and then discovered about 2 months before he was about to leave that his wife was pregnant. And he still went.
Wow. You know, among the individuals of the species in this series, one of the more interesting is a 92-year-old Homo sapien named David Attenborough.
Yes.
We see him out in the bush. He delivers this compelling narration. Just tell us about what he brought to this project.
There was only one person who I could ever be the person to tell the stories in this series, and that was David. Because for so many reasons. One, because I think it's a new approach, and I think the audience needed to be introduced to what we were trying to do with this story and how it was going to work. And of course, if he stands there at the beginning and says, let me tell you a story, most people are going to say, okay, I'll listen to this story, because he is the world's greatest storyteller. But also, I think the way he delivers these stories allowed us to tread the line between the truth and the drama of the truth without stepping into melodrama or something that felt untrue. That there's something about the conviction and the passion and the knowledge that he has absolutely makes you absolutely follow those stories with an extraordinary intensity. One of the outcomes of that is that I thought we needed him to come out on location with us and introduce the series from location and set out in a what we call a piece to camera, in other words, addressing the audience directly about what we were trying to do with the series. And that's a challenge. He's 92 years old. I mean, he's an extraordinarily fit and healthy man, but I nevertheless had that responsibility, and nobody wants to be the person who killed David Attenborough. So we were pretty careful that that didn't happen. But we went to Zimbabwe for about 10 days to shoot. We used that as a generic location to introduce the series and each of the episodes. And then, because that's also the location where we filmed the whole story of the Painted Wolves, we were actually able to get a specific closing to the Painted Wolves film with him in the absolutely signature David Attenborough thing, which is David Attenborough standing next to the animals, delivering his great lines, and then turning to the animals. And we were able to do that with the Painted Wolves. And it was an amazing experience to do it, because I've worked with him for 30-odd years and done many of those things, and I wasn't sure that would happen again. And to be able to do it one more time was amazing.
Well, Michael Gunton, it's a fascinating series. Thanks so much for spending some time with us.
It's been a pleasure. I hope you all enjoy it.
Michael Gunton is the executive producer of the BBC series Dynasties. It premiered January 19th and is being shown on BBC America, AMC, IFC, and Sundance TV, and will soon be available on demand. Gunton spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies, who is also WHYY's senior reporter. Perhaps no instrument is more identified with rock and folk music than the guitar. Rock critic Ken Tucker has been listening to two new albums by very different yet connected guitarists. Steve Gunn is an instrumentalist turned singer-songwriter. His new album is The Unseen In Between. Michael Chapman is a veteran British folk musician whose new album is called True North. Steve Gunn produced it. Here's Ken's review.
Vacancy and burned out fracture, an empty stare from a vagrant catcher, a vagabond. Bag is packed and you move along.
Steve Gunn is primarily a guitarist. He'd put out at least a half dozen records before he started singing on 2013's Time Off album. As a guitarist, Gunn has been influenced by the finger-picking styles of Sandy Bull and John Fahey, but he's not as eccentric or mercurial as either of those assiduous rebels. Gunn's music tends toward a more soothing sound, as can be heard on New Moon, a dreamy, almost weightless song.
I see a glimmer across the wall. Out past the streets, beyond the weather, to that lake no one seems to know.
Another new song, Stonehurst Cowboy, is written about Gunn's father, who had died shortly before Gunn wrote it. Featuring Gunn on acoustic guitar and Richard Garnier on bass, it's about revisiting his dad's old neighborhood in Philadelphia, then switches to his own point of view as he realizes the similarities in his own sensibility and his father's.
Dear house near 69, old street looks the same. Trees are straw, faces are gone, background still the same. Shadow in the sea of a dream to me, Stonehurst, Long Lane. Back then friends, brothers and me, all got sent away. Came back feeling so undone, without much to say. Sat for hours, stared at your flowers, found ways to hide the pain. Stole your car, drove real far, no one can explain. Fastest hands in the West, car.
call his name. He knows best. Tonight I'll pass the world.
I would guess that Michael Chapman is roughly twice as old as Steve Gunn, who calls Chapman one of my heroes. Gunn says he admires Chapman for being, quote, in his 70s, still pushing along, still doing it. What Chapman does, at age 78 to be exact, is subtle. It's his own version of folk music, mixed with singer-songwriter confessionalism that takes inspiration from both British romantic poetry of the 19th century and American hard-boiled fiction of the 20th.
There's ghosts out in the corridors of this broken-down hotel. The place is full of strangers. Some don't wish me well. And I wake up with a bottle of something strong and cheap. And far too many memories I'm trying not to keep. Cause we were kept apart by a cruel twist of fate. I never knew I wanted you until it was too late. Cause we were kept apart by a cruel twist of fate. I never knew I wanted you until it was too late. Until it was too late.
The production on this Michael Chapman album, True North, overseen by Steve Gunn, sounds as though Chapman was playing guitar and singing in a dark, drafty, high-ceiling chamber in a very old house. Some dank guest room in Downton Abbey. His electric and acoustic guitar playing sends out spidery lines of melody that cling to the lyrics he croaks out.
A country girl singing soft and low is tearing me apart. I'm wasting time in a smoky room full bar. Empty heart. I never minded all the miles. Seems like I was born to roam. But I just wish you'd walk right in and take this roamer home. I got nothing more to give.
Listening to these two albums, it occurred to me that the British Michael Chapman sounds more American than the native Pennsylvanian Steve Gunn. What both share is a faith in the guitar as an instrument capable of suggesting all of the mystery, confusion, and complex delight that life presents them with.
Ken Tucker is Fresh Air's rock critic. He reviewed new albums by Steve Gunn and Michael Chapman. Coming up, we talk with neuroscientist Judith Grizel, author of Never Enough, The Neuroscience and Experience of Addiction. She'll talk about how the brain responds to addictive drugs and alcohol. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Dreamwave, maker of luxury massage chairs from Japan, with shiatsu point detection and 16 programmed massages, including morning, night, and stretch sessions. Retailers nationwide. More at dreamwavechair.com. And from Capterra, for helping people find the right software for their business. From marketing automation to winery management software, users can read reviews and compare solutions across hundreds of software categories. More at capterra.com.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Judith Grizel, is a neuroscientist who studies how addictive drugs work on the brain and why they're so hard to give up, whether they're illicit drugs like heroin and cocaine or prescription drugs like opiates and certain anti-anxiety and insomnia medications. Grizel is also a recovering addict, 30 years sober, who started drinking when she was 13 and later added marijuana and cocaine. Grizel has written a new book called Never Enough: The Neuroscience and Experience of Addiction. She's a professor of psychology at Bucknell University. Her recent research has been investigating how men and women respond differently to alcohol. Judith Grizel, welcome to Fresh Air. So you write that you decided to study the neurological basis of addiction because you started to think that your addiction might have a neurological base, that maybe there was a way of explaining it and therefore a way of fixing it. What made you aware that there might be a biological model, a neurological model, and what initially seemed to fit with your experience?
I think I'm always interested in the mechanisms of things. I think that was something that was in me as a child. My mother says I spent the first 10 years of my life turning over rocks. So I think it's just something about me that is inclined to look at explanations in terms of mechanism. And when I heard that I had a disease, I kind of felt naturally that that would have a biological basis. And I figured that I could study that biological basis and understand it and then maybe fix it.
So when you started learning about the neurochemistry of addiction, did you have any moments where you thought, yes, that's how I felt, yes, that explains me?
One after another. So that was really enlightening for me. There is a common substrate for all addictions in the neurochemistry, in dopamine pathways. And it made perfect sense to me that my dopamine pathways were especially tuned to hear signals from drugs and other things.
You started drinking when you were 13, which is pretty young. Why is it especially bad to start drinking and using drugs when you're still an adolescent?
Yes, we're seeing more and more how this period in adolescence, when people are figuring out who they are, what they care about, what they like, what they dislike, who they want to be with, what they want to study, all those things are that way at this time because their brain is so plastic. And what I mean by plastic is it's undergoing unbelievable amounts of remodeling. So the changes in behavior that happen during adolescence are so important and lasting because the brain is forming permanent structures. So whatever you experience as an adolescent is going to have a much more impactful influence on the rest of your life's trajectory than it would, say, if you did this at another time in development when your brain wasn't so prone to changing.
So since your brain is very plastic and still modeling when you're an adolescent, if you start using alcohol or any drug when you're, say, 13, mm-hmm. like you did, does it change the way your brain matures?
Yeah, so when the circuits are being laid down, if they're laid down under the influence of a drug, then they're going to be laid down differently than if it's not under the influence of a drug. If you start using at 28, when the circuits are already more or less set, then you're not going to have such a long-lasting impact.
Are you more likely to become addicted if you start using alcohol or any kind of addictive substance and you're an adolescent?
Absolutely, for exactly this reason. So 80% at least of people who have a substance use disorder started before they were 18.
You also write, pertaining to yourself, that you were almost never sick or hungover from drinking. Did that have to do with your age, too?
Probably partly. So my liver was young and fresh. I think that helped. But also, people like me who are prone to alcoholism, for instance, are known to be those who can take their drinking pretty well. So if you take a big drink sometime early on and you get really wildly sick and can't control yourself, you're less likely to then drink again. So for me and others like me, it's mostly good and not bad really early on.
A lot of college students are into binge drinking. So figure 18 to 22 years old, is the brain still more plastic or has it matured by then?
No, we see that probably it's not mature until about 25. And this is a really critical time. We see definitely lasting changes on the brain and behavior. So binge drinking certainly predisposes toward alcoholism. And it also alters the circuits, the connections between nerve cells and the pathways, including the dopamine pathway. So, yes, it's not just drinking early or how much you drink, but the pattern that you drink. And binge drinking is probably the worst pattern if you want to predispose toward problem use.
Do women metabolize alcohol differently than men?
They do. The same amount of alcohol has a bigger impact on women, a higher risk for physical or for addictive problems. And that is because they metabolize it less well than men. So the same amount of alcohol has a bigger impact on a woman's body and brain than on a man's.
Why is that?
There are a couple reasons. One is that women have more body fat, so there's not as much blood supplying fat as it's supplying muscle. So the same weighted woman, let's say 130-pound woman and 130-pound man, the man will have more blood, and so the alcohol is more diluted in the man than in the woman, so it's higher concentration in the female. But also, she transports alcohol out of her stomach faster. It's metabolized more slowly. So there's higher concentrations for those two reasons.
When you started drinking when you were 13, what need do you feel like alcohol was serving in your life?
Yeah, it's funny how I didn't recognize the need until I had a drink. So for me, I had had little sips here and there at family parties and things, but the first time I got as much as I wanted was when I was 13, and I drank probably a little more than a half a gallon of wine, splitting this with a friend in her parents' basement. And I suddenly felt less anxious, less insecure, less inept to cope with the world. I felt like there was this, suddenly I was full and okay in a way that I had never been.
And do you think that has to do with the way you're wired?
I guess it must. I mean, it was so complete and so profound. I really remember thinking like, aha, I can get through my life now. I didn't even know, I was probably not the most happy-go-lucky kid, but I was sort of getting through okay. But once I found that ticket, and it felt like a ticket to me, I suddenly realized, wow, this is how people survive the pains of living. What the neurochemistry underlies that is something that I've been pursuing for 30 years since then, but I think there are probably lots of explanations. I think that one of them might involve endorphins, and I study this as a topic of research, and it's not, you know, it's one of thousands of ways to get at this problem, but it looks like people who are prone to alcoholism because they have alcoholics in their family or they're somehow genetically at risk have lower levels of endorphin. And we know endorphin as a kind of a natural morphine-like compound. And so morphine or endorphins make us feel at peace and restful and not suffering and sort of at ease. And so I think I may have a deficiency of endorphin, and because alcohol is a terrific stimulator of endorphin synthesis and release, it's likely that when I drank all that wine, I suddenly was flooded with endorphins, and that's partly why I felt so great.
People take drugs because they think the drugs make them feel good. But as you point out, if you're taking an addictive drug, after a while, the drugs just kind of make you feel normal. They don't get you high anymore. But if you stop using the drug, you feel sick. You feel you're in pain. You feel really terrible. So there's a neurological explanation for that. And you say that has to do with the fact that the brain is always trying to bring you into a state of homeostasis, into a state of stability. So the brain compensates for things that are unusual that are going on. So how does that figure into addiction?
Yeah, the brain compensates for regular unusual things, you could say. So the more you take a drug to change the way you feel, the more your brain produces the exact opposite state. And it does that so that you're at this stable, homeostatic baseline, and you can tell if something important is happening. So I drink coffee every morning. I wouldn't think of not drinking it. And when I wake up, I don't really wake up. I drag myself out of bed straight to the coffee pot. Before I talk to my family or my pets, I'm making the coffee because I don't feel awake and then enhanced by the coffee. I feel lethargic because my brain knows that coffee is coming and that when the coffee arrives, now I feel normal. And it's the case for every single drug. If you take a drug to feel awake, you'll produce lethargy. If you take a drug to feel relaxed, you'll produce anxiety and tension.
You'll produce that when you don't have the drug.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, or even as you take the drug, so that it doesn't really work so well, so that makes you tolerant to the drug. So someone who's a naive user will get a big experience of the drug, but a regular user just feels about normal.
And does that figure into why it's so hard to give up a drug?
Absolutely, because without the drug, then you feel less than normal. You have this adapted brain state that will only feel normal when the drug is delivered. So your craving is focused specifically on getting back to the normal state. So that it's really, you know, what once was a luxury or felt especially wonderful now just makes you feel okay.
You rarely did opioids. They weren't as readily accessible as they are today when you were having problems with drugs. You're right, it's hard to overestimate the power of the hold opiates have come to have on their users. Why are opiates so highly addictive?
Yeah, I think especially now, their effects are so ones that we would value or that we do value. So opiates make a user feel like they are not suffering, that they are completely content, completely comfortable, completely well, that everything is okay the way it is. And I think that for that reason, they're so attractive because often we don't experience that things are okay the way they are. So they are kind of a perfect antidote to suffering of any kind.
But the problem is?
The problem is if we reduce suffering and we produce euphoria using opiates, the brain adapts. And so now we don't feel high and completely content with them. We just feel not sick and miserable. And when we take them away, we feel full of suffering, much more suffering than we had started with to begin with. So the brain produces its own type of suffering.
So one of the things you object to in the book is the use of methadone to counteract addiction in young people to heroin or any other opiate. What's the problem with methadone, especially for young people?
Methadone is a pure substitute addiction. So it takes the place of other opiates. It's easier for society because it's very long-lasting, so people aren't going through this really intense period of withdrawal. They can take it once a day. It's orally active, so that gets around the problem of finding clean needles and not making a mess on the street. They drink a little juice. It's very cheap, so it's easy to administer. It's cheap, and it lasts a long time, and it makes the user not withdraw. So for the rest of us, it's kind of a nice thing because these people who are opiate dependent are kind of out of the way. They're not so hard to deal with. But for those users, especially if they're young, it's even harder to get off of methadone than it is to get off of, say, heroin, because it lasts such a long time. It really bathes the brain much longer. The adaptation is really profound. So it was a decent strategy, I guess, when we had these kind of career addicts. They had been using for 20 or 30 years, and there wasn't much hope of them ever getting off. But I think today, Suboxone is a much better choice because it doesn't completely substitute for an opiate. It's a kind of a halfway substitute. It helps keep away the withdrawal, but it doesn't really produce much of a high. And so that enables people, especially if they're motivated to get clean, to get through that really difficult period of craving when they can't sleep and they can't sit still and they can't bear the suffering, to sort of get through that and then maybe to titrate down.
So is Suboxone less addictive than methadone?
To me it is, because it's less long-lasting and it's less potent at stimulating the pleasure pathways.
How common is the use of Suboxone in treating addiction and at recovery centers?
I think it's getting more and more common. It's much more expensive, which is part of the issue. So I think it's harder to get, and it's harder to pay for by state and local governments, but I think it is a much better choice.
So you became a neuroscientist studying the effects of addiction on the brain because you were a recovering addict yourself and you wanted to understand yourself better and then contribute to the knowledge of addiction and recovery. A lot of people in recovery relapse. Do you think that your growing knowledge as you were in recovery, you know, especially early on, do you think that your growing knowledge about addiction, about the neuroscience of addiction, helped you to stay away from the drugs that you had used?
Yes, I do. And I first should say I wasn't all that altruistic in the beginning. I think I wanted to study addiction so I could use better.
Seriously?
Yeah. I think it was a little unconscious, but I figured if it's a disease and diseases can be cured and I can cure it, then maybe I can still use. So that was kind of my deep motivation. But eventually, I do think it really helped me because I had something to focus on that was not about how to get and hide my using, you know, get high and then hide it. But I could focus my sort of little bit compulsive energy on graduate school and studying. And I think that was useful. I do think that I have more compassion for myself, and I recognize that I didn't start out, you know, kind of like a blank slate. I started out with certain tendencies that make drugs for me so valuable and important that really the courage and the perseverance that I've demonstrated over 30 years trying to both study this and to stay clean and sober is something that I'm proud of.
Judith Grizzell, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor.
Judith Grizzell is a neuroscientist and author of the new book, Never Enough, The Neuroscience and Experience of Addiction. She's a professor of psychology at Bucknell University. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Muj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to providing holistic financial planning, from taxes and investments to retirement and estate planning, in the client's best interest. Let'sMakeAPlan.org. And from Progressive Insurance, offering a way to buy home insurance with their Home Quote Explorer tool. Custom quotes and rates are available online. Learn more at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's Progressive.